am hosted tonight by Adam Mose and myself, Tamara Wickma. Love in the 21st Century is a talk show with live call-ins, interviews, and discussions on the philosophical to practical look of love, from romantic relationships to connections with humanity. One-third dating insights, one-third self-love guide, one-third compassion training. And tonight will be the second installment on our the Love Stories series. So stay tuned. Call in if you have something to share, something to comment on. The number that gets you directly on the air is 895-1114. Welcome back to Love in the 21st Century, here with Adam Mose, and we are talking about love stories. Thank you so much for being here, Adam.
Oh, my pleasure.
And the inspiration to talk about love stories is that there's just so many ways to be thinking of love and what stories we talk about in love. Well, last week we had a segment played from a previous show with Julian, where we talked about where our idea of love comes from. And then we listened to a love story from a radio program called Modern Love. And this man's story about a relationship that ended. And so it's just interesting when we start to think about what stories would we tell if we were to tell one about love. And so Adam has crafted today's show with that in mind.
So we're talking about the overarching cosmic love story that all of our love stories are a part of,
mm-hmm.
which is how the humans all got over themselves and decided to make it a beautifully abundant and wholesome place to live on the planet Earth, and then ultimately all became enlightened beings. This is the cosmic love story that I'm envisioning that we're all kind of participants in that way, that the big one.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, people would language it in different ways, but like how we're able to be more loving is endless. It always can improve. It always develops. Why it's called like a boundless, something that's always going deeper and going further and revealing more and more of who you actually are, is because it's something basic to who we all are. The loving and the compassionate and the joyfulness and the even keel, the evenness of it all, being able to take it all in stride. All these things are the type of story that we want to tell and the type of life that we want to live. And I think being able to make this our specific focus now for this short amount of time, I think it would be very wonderful. So in that, I have my particular love stories that I've encountered in this life. And I mean, all of this comes from mom and dad. Originally, they were being gentle and loving and, you know, sometimes jumping in and totally saving my butt from dying and then helping me out in big ways. So, of course, it's mom and dad and the family that initially I'm learning about love and how it's applied in the practical sense. But then in terms of like who I'm becoming and how it is I'm relating in the world now, there was these four amazing instances of love which we could put into forms of stories. And that is like meeting the Dharma for me was this deep kind of falling in love. And it occurred at a very crucial juncture in my life. I think it was like junior in college, and I took a philosophy course on Buddhism, particularly is a specific Buddhist philosophy course. And so it wasn't like, oh, here's the religion. It was just about the general philosophical background that any Buddhist would say, oh, that's, you know, what Buddhism is about. So it was just like coming home in a deeper, more expansive way than I could ever have imagined. And the stuff, the philosophy that they were communicating, it was like, I had thought of that. I had actually, you know, come to these realizations silently in my own life and hadn't the words to put them into communication. And then finally here was someone, you know, just saying, okay, this is how you look at things if you're a Buddhist. And so I'm like, holy cow, I guess I'm a Buddhist, but I would have never, you know, my upbringing, I had no contact with this. My folks were not dogmatic in their faith necessarily, but it turns out their faith was atheism. And we kid, you know, it's like, oh, that isn't that the lack of any faith? No, actually, it takes a certain amount of belief to be a atheist, even to be a materialist. And to believe that there's nothing other than real sense that requires a degree of belief, of conviction from one's own side. So, the meaning of the Dharma was a very big stretch for me, you know, like leaving the faith of my upbringing in a way, and starting to see a bigger picture to what's going on with this whole human experience, this whole human drama. And it was mirrored also, like when I really started to get into the practice of it, the Buddhist class was just the overview of all the philosophy and was so delightful. But it naturally, I was wanting to get more involved with the meditation and the practice of it. So I sought out a Zen place. And actually, that's a whole other love story, phenomenal thing. I was living in Berkeley and I had a warehouse. This is like the mid-80s. And I was determined to be the coolest, most edgiest, you know, I could be. So my buddy and I rented this pretty big warehouse, and we were going to make it into this like communal living space, art space thing. And the rent was pretty steep, even for back in those days, because it was massive. It was like this huge empty warehouse space. And we started gathering supplies and stuff like that. But we were both working, so we were working in construction. So we just had to work so hard to keep the place floating. And then we'd throw parties. It was like right before the rave scene. You know, there were some friends kind of orbiting who were like, we got these new records, you know, coming from Europe. You got to let us do like a DJ party. But that hadn't hit. So it was cosmic, you know, because that would have been a whole other scene. But we had like punk bands come in, and then we were living in these tents. We'd like suspend them from the ceiling, these large rigid tents that would like be individual rooms for people. And then when we had a big party, they'd go up to the roof, stuff like that. You know, we were able to be creative in the life. But one day I was just like, I gotta, you know, get serious about what am I doing, and I took off and just was driving in the back country of Sonoma County, and ended up sleeping this kind of fitful night, you know, not much sleep in my car. There was raining, and I pulled into this little redwood grove. There's like this one little random redwood grove on top of Sonoma Mountain, and didn't sleep so much, but in the morning the clouds lifted and it was blue sky and beautiful, and I was just walking along the road and I saw this big rock balanced on this narrow metal fence post. I'm like, that's interesting, you know, there's something to that. It weathered the storm, and it's like just hanging there. So that was like the first hint something was up. So then I went a little further, and there was this massive oak tree that just was covering over this beautiful little farmhouse. And it's kind of like a drive. I was just kind of walking, looking, and this this short Japanese woman in a kimono, or like this black gown, she comes out and she asks, you know, you're here for the meditation instructions? I'm like, yes, I am. And this was the Roshi's wife, Laura Kwong. Jakushu Kwong was the abbot of Sonoma Mountain Zen Center. And it was there I decided to stay. You know, I got the meditation instruction, and it was like the first real kind of detailed practical instructions on how to work with my mind that I had ever received. So valuable and wonderful. But then as I deepened my practice with the Sangha there, beautiful Sangha on Sonoma Mountain, Laura continued to be a very important teacher, also along with the main abbot, Jakushu Kwang Roshi. But she was saying how, like, when she would do these sesshins, which are these longer sits, where you do, like, a very extensive schedule of practice all throughout the day. It's like lots and lots of meditation. You just go way deep in it. She's like, it felt like falling in love. Mm-hmm. Like that same kind of floating other world, you know, you're just finding this deeper and deeper place within yourself, which is already loving. You can't help but fall in love with that. So that was part of my first contact with Buddhism. And then somehow I knew that Zen wasn't the be-all end-all for me, in a way, that I had started meeting folks who were tantric teachers and were working more in the householder, like really in the everyday living. You know, I got so much from being able to be up there on Sonoma Mountain, but it was still very removed. You had to really be up there, and the kind of really in the flow, in the everyday, kind of having the meditation there was more interesting. And that eventually led me to one of my great spiritual friends, Fritz, and then to travel to India and then take refuge, which is the first step in becoming an actual Buddhist. You know, you think how so much of the modern philosophy and practices, like mindfulness, now is very, very popular, very widespread practice, taught in schools and all over the corporate world. People are like, oh, you know, you're a happier person if you have a degree of mindfulness going on. But the actual way in you become, like, from being a heart Buddhist to being an actual Buddhist, there's a ritual, there's like a delineation called taking refuge. And I was in the commissary for the Library of Tibetan Works and Archives, which was absolutely amazing, brilliant place that the Dalai Lama, his Tibetan government in exile, set up in Dharamsala up in North India, the state of Himachal Pradesh, where, like, there's so many, many incredible books from all the different spiritual traditions, from all the different sciences, and of course, Buddhism and the Tibetan Buddhism. It was like the goldmine library. And, you know, they let me check out books. I check out four a day and read just nonstop while I was over there. And then they had classes, practices. And then sure enough, they fed everyone too. Like, it was like part of the outreach, the generosity of the Tibetan government in exile. So I was sitting around a table with a friend and this very heavyset Belgian monk. He was a Westerner who had taken the robes. And they said, "You haven't taken refuge yet? You're such an avid, you know, Buddhist student and meditator." It's like, of course, you want to take refuge. I'm like, yes. So like, well, we know just the person for you. His name is Nagpa Yeshe Dorje. And I'll take you to him right after lunch. I'm like, fantastic. This is it. This is the next step. So I go with this Belgian gentleman and we start to walk. The Library of Tibetan Works and Archives is a good ways down the hill. Dharamsala is a hill station. So there's like one part of the town, and then up, there's a whole other part. So we start walking up the hill, and we go about 100 feet, and there's a chai shop. And this is a phenomenon in India. You can go like 100 in certain places. You go 100 feet in any direction, you'll find a chai shop. And then you go another 100 feet, you'll find another one. We hit every chai shop on the way up. And this he was kind of like Hoti, the fabled the fat Buddha you see in the Chinese restaurants, who's not a real Buddha, he's an arhat, but his name Hoti, and he's like so jolly and generous, and that's how this guy was. He was just really, he knew all of the chai shop guys on a first name basis, and they, you know, order everyone chai. And we have a little biscuits and chai, and then we walk a little further. We stop. He's like, can we stop for a chai? I'm like, absolutely, no problem. And then it went on and on. And then we got finally up to the top of Dharamsala. McLeod Ganj is this other little place. And then we go to the Osho store. And he knows everybody. And then the evening wears on, and now it's getting dark. And we're finally walking along this road, and then he points up this steep driveway going up. He's like, Nagpesha Dorje is up there. I'm not going to go up the big hill. Like, thank you so much. You know, it was like a test. It was cosmically like this test to keep me on focus. I'm like, yes, I really want to take refuge. So then this is 1990, before cell phones, before, like, even there wasn't any phones in India at that time. You know, you had to go to a special shop and wait in line to use the one phone that was available. But when I arrived at the monastery, Nagpayeshe Dorje was out in front, and he's like, what took you so long? There's no time for taking refuge today. Come back tomorrow. How would he have known? It was one of those beautiful cosmic things. So I did. I was able to come back the next day and the next day and the next day and the next day, and then took refuge and have amazing, beautiful teachings one-on-one with him and his translator. He didn't speak much English, but was very, very supportive and very, very generous with me and two other Westerners, and we took refuge and we had teachings, and that was like how I really felt like, okay, now I'm on the path, now I have a practice, and everything's going to change. Everything changed in the life, very much. But it evolved into this way, like when I came back from India, the culture shock coming back to the U.S. was worse than the culture shock of going to India initially. There was a culture shock getting into the India way of life. But when I was over there, the India way of life seemed to make so much more sense. It's on a such more human-to-human scale. There's no big corporations. There's no big supermarkets. It's all like the farmer's market has taken over the world. There's no big stores. Everything is the farmer's market. Was how it was. So when I came back and I was trying to integrate, I was like, oh, this is pretty weird. Where's the people? And I discovered the Rainbow Family and could live out in the woods and do my practices. I could do my sadhanas that I received in India, and help out in the kitchen, chop wood, carry water, cook occasionally, and could live out in the woods. And then I would work. I'd come into town, and for 3 months out of the year, I'd paint houses, like be my own kind of under-the-table paint contractor. Started with my folks' house. I paint their house, and did a really good job, and employed a bunch of my friends, and then made enough money, I could be out in the forests all the rest of the year. So somehow that wasn't, you know, that was, had worked like up to that point. And it leads in perfectly with my next big love story, which was meeting my future wife at a rainbow gathering. And this was a regional gathering. There's these annual gatherings which can be quite large, and they're once a year. the regional gatherings happen at various times throughout the year and even in the winter. And this was in the Mendocino National Forest. So this was the first gathering ever that I got off the internet. Like, I went to a library and they just had a text browser and I was able to find, you know, oh, where it's going to be, when it's going to be. And so that was a bit like a part of the technological revolution. Like, we could coordinate, not just by word of mouth. Usually you had to hear about where the gathering was because you got a little mimeographed copy that's called a howdy folks. And it has the lowdown on where the gathering's going to be. This was the first one that was like electronically communicated. So I went up there and set up my little camp. And then the first day I was there, I saw this beautiful sister running up the side of the hill. And the first thought in my mind was, Fritz would really like that one. And I didn't know why. I never had thought, you know, such a thing before. But it might have been that she was a redhead at the time, and Fritz had a thing for redheads. Or should I say, redheads had a thing for Fritz. Mm-hmm. He's, you know, my spiritual friend who really got me tracked into the Vajrayana tantric way of Buddhism. But we had a real magnetic falling in love kind of a rainbow gathering. And at the end of it, we're like, do you want to travel with me a little bit? Like, let's have a spiritual odyssey. And she was down for it. So we just traveled a couple more days around. She had a flight she had to catch back to New York City. She's from the East Coast, fully New York City girl. But it turned out there was another gathering. No, I think, well, what happened was I proposed. And don't try this at home, kids, right? But I'd known her a full, you know, like, week and a half. And asked,
week and a half.
Asked if she'd like to marry me. And
what did she say?
She said she'd think it over. But she's a lady who knows her mind, so it didn't take her very long. Thanks. The tricky part was calling the folks. We thought, what do you do next? Oh, maybe you call the parents. Mm-hmm. So I actually, you know, called her dad, and mm-hmm. and it was fantastic. He was like, "Are you kidding? You're running off with some rainbow crazy hippie?" He was being honest. He's protecting his little girl.
Mm-hmm.
And we're like, kind of like that reggae song, "I'm gonna marry her anyway." It wasn't in so many words,
mm-hmm.
but it was kind of like, you know, it would help if we had your blessing. It's not a mandatory thing. And eventually, they kind of came around to it.
Eventually, before you were married, or eventually after you were married?
A little of both. I think they were still kind of on the fence, you know, because we had this. A rainbow, another regional coming up.
Mm-hmm.
And we said, we'll just get married out of this regional. So there wasn't any time for our negation or negotiation. It was just, and it was a fully spontaneous, romantic rainbow wedding of spirit, which was nice. We didn't have to do any planning, any arranging. It was sunset, and we're out on the beach at Point Reyes under this massive eucalyptus tree. And this violinist happens to show up, and he's like, oh, I'll play the music for you guys. And then we passed out this little vows that Fritz had been using to help people who wanted to make efforts towards harmony. That's what he called it, making efforts towards harmony. And we just recited it as the sun went down, and boy, something happened. Something just shifted, and it's like, okay, that was for real. And
how long after the proposal was this?
This is a couple days.
Oh, it's a couple days. Okay.
Like a week. Okay. Maybe a week.
So a week and a half in, there was the proposal, and then yep. A week later, you were married?
Exactly. Like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then she took off for...
New York City.
New York City.
And how long was it before you saw her again?
I think we had a month or so. And the idea was to meet up in St. Louis, and go to the national gathering, the annual gathering, which was in Missouri, and then take it from there. So that was like our honeymoon. We had the full-on rainbow honeymoon, and all of my friends were like, you know, you get a round-trip ticket, keep your return flight. And all of her friends were like, it's a big mistake, you're throwing away all this beautiful scene in New York City for what, you know? So it sometimes is like that when you really have to make a brave shift. Even your dearest friends, even your best household, these are still our dearest friends, you know, old friends. They might not give you the right advice. You got to follow your heart.
Mm-hmm. Followed your heart. What, has it been 20 years now?
Yes.
Yeah. So 2.5 weeks, made the right choice.
But we also, you know, the rainbow gathering was our honeymoon, and then we kept on this honeymoon for 6 months. We just lived out of our backpacks and went from gathering to gathering, and went to beautiful national forests, and went to hot springs. That was one of our main focuses, was just to go to the wild hot springs. And we lived very free and wild and got to know how we related to one another. So that was, you know, the way, just super intense, super deep, and healing also. The past relationships that I had that, you know, worked from to some extent, you know, healing and seeing why this has gone further, why this was something else. Similar with her, you know, we had entered this whole new world. Mm-hmm. This is how it felt.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'm revealing myself. I'm a hopeless romantic. Yeah. But it's true. Love, rainbow love can come. I would have never thunk.
Yeah, and it did. It did come for you and for Dina. 20 years, and continue to strengthen your relationship within yourself, it sounds like. Beautiful.
Then a year later, we did a second wedding for all of our families.
Mm.
We invited them. But we still kept it pretty true to our rainbow roots. Like, we had it in Big Sur, and it was just very simple, very uncomplicated. We had a rabbi, because her family practicing Jewish. And we had a lama in my Tibetan tradition. So it was really beautiful coming together of all of our different families and faiths, and that was kind of like, heads up, warning everybody, we're going to have kids. It's like, you know, we're really serious about this now. And that kind of leads into, I guess you could say, my love, my big love of Chinese medicine was about to happen. And that was something, you know, I was always thinking I'm going to go back to school. I had my BA, but I wanted to get a master's or a PhD in something and continue with that. She already had her master's and was doing nursing and tending towards midwifery. I thought, Buddhist studies, you know, like being a Buddhist scholar. And then I was like, it's hard to like feed a family in that way. It would be more like I'd be in academia and have to teach or write and things like that. And in those days, I looked at the Buddhist studies programs and they were like, you can't be a Buddhist and be in Buddhist studies. Like, you had to be critical and objective and approach it from this dissecting, you know, like you didn't even admit your bias was that you were a Buddhist. And I thought that was pretty odd. That's changed, you know, in the subsequent years. There's more programs that are for users, you know, for people who are practically applying it in their lives and to themselves. But that also kind of, you know, like, that doesn't make sense. I want something that I can apply, something that's practical, something that incorporates the Eastern philosophy and my psychology background and my massage therapy background, and something that's medical, because she was nursing, she was medical. And so, bam, Chinese medicine just was like, yes, this is where you need to be. And similarly, as soon as I committed to that, you know, I felt the love of it and I felt it pulling me in. But it was like kind of that tough love that I needed at that point, you know, because I'd been living in the woods and doing my thing and it's been pretty relaxed. I was very free, easy in how I scheduled myself. So Chinese medicine was my tough love, you know, kind of. It was like, you're going to work hard at this and you're going to get into debt to learn how to do all this, you know. But when you're done with it, you'll have something very valuable to offer folks. And, you know, my love, my admiration for the medicine just keeps growing year by year. That's the thing. The formulas and the diagnosis, even how you don't treat diseases, you know, you treat the person, and how you're able to describe the person through the Chinese diagnosis sounds like poems, is poetic. And then the formulas, like when I make a really good formula, it's like a love poem that they can put in their body and feel better with. You know, it's like a tangible hunk of wisdom and love, you know, that's for them. So that's the amazing thing. That's just such an honor to be able to keep progressing in that. And now to offer it back. I'm starting to teach Chinese medicine in an open way on Wednesday mornings. You want to come in, it's free for anyone. At my clinic Wednesday mornings at 9 o'clock, I'm teaching Chinese medicine. And then there's a learning cadre. There's a group of folks who are dedicated to following it as a path. And myself and two other acupuncturists in this area, we're all taking on students, apprentices. So we're going to teach them all together as like a learning cadre. And it's because Chico's a bit remote. It's hard to, you know, there's no quick access to a school of Chinese medicine. Those are all in the Bay Area. So this is what we're coming up with to help train the next generation of awesome practitioners of Chinese medicine.
Yeah, it sounds like an amazing opportunity.
Yeah, everyone's welcome.
So that was Wednesday mornings at 9 o'clock at your clinic?
At Acupuncture and Herbs, that's right.
Beautiful. Are we moving towards some other love stories here that you'd like to share with the last 20 minutes of
I would love to. I have, of course, the cosmic love story of marriage led to the even more cosmic love story of daughters.
Mm.
And daughter number one was, I was just, still am, you know, goo goo gaga. Baby love is like unbelievable. They say like, oh, there's this bubble. You're in the baby bubble.
Mm-hmm.
And it's true. They're just like love generators.
Mm-hmm.
Little kids, when they come through and they're just so present and so open. And it was at a very interesting time because I was right in the crunch of my learning Chinese medicine.
Mm-hmm.
And little Clarabelle, as our firstborn, was so inspiring to me with how she learned, how, you know, everything and every day they're getting to be more of who they are. They're learning, and they're just, you know, like fiercely determined to understand their world and make it work for them.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, physically, she took her first steps, you know, while I was taking my very first steps mm-hmm. in Chinese medicine. You know, I was, like, learning my body, learning all the different categories and all the different points and all the herbs and all the diagnoses, and it's, like, this huge jumble of stuff. And then, like, when she was taking her first steps, and I was like, okay, now I got to put this all together and actually, like, help people feel better.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a really exciting time. But one of the curious things about the daughter, we had all these different names that we were thinking about, if it was a boy, if it was a girl. And they weren't gelling. It wasn't actually coming. So I took this walk in the redwoods up there. We were in Santa Cruz. And then, clear as a bell, mm-hmm. the name Clarabelle,
mm.
like I heard, I didn't think it.
Wow.
It was one of those things, you know. I was just like, oh, who is this? Who is this? So I kind of think she named herself, but amazing, just like that first instant seeing her,
mm-hmm.
the newborn little person, and it was like, oh, that's who it was. It was like heavy,
mm-hmm.
you know. It wasn't like, oh, that's the baby. It's like, no, it's that person,
mm-hmm.
you know. It felt like that right from the start. So intense. Okay, it's hard to describe. We were able to have a home birth
mm-hmm.
in our little apartment. We had this teeny tiny little apartment in Santa Cruz. But we made it as comfy, cozy as we could, you know. And Dina was epic and was able to rock it. Did it at home with the midwife. We were so excited, you know. We didn't know there's like this warm up labor that goes on for some days sometimes before the actual labor starts. And we're like, oh, this is it. This is the labor. And we were so psyched. We like stayed up for 3 days. You're supposed to say, just relax. You know, this is the warm-ups. It's not the actual thing. You know, you got to let it come when it comes. But somehow we survived. It's incredible. And then I have like hours and hours of old time video footage of the little baby like spitting up or like smiling from passing gas. And it was just like, I was crazy about her.
Mm-hmm.
Just can't take my eyes off her. So that's just the whole other blow your mind realm of love.
Mm-hmm.
When you think about how a Buddha loves beings. Everyone so unconditionally, that same kind of love, you know, that I felt for my first daughter, and of course, felt for my second daughter when she came. And we knew a little bit more about what not to do.
Mm-hmm.
And had our own place, our own home in paradise. Things were a lot smoother, actually. For our second daughter, Sophia. And we were still in the bubble, still in the love, you know, from number one. So number two was just so much more chill, in a way. So much more relaxed. The kids that go first, they have, you know, they have to break ground. They have to, like, get the parents into being good parents.
They're pioneers.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And then the second ones, the baby of the families, they got it easier. And we were like, you know, how Clarabelle used to holler when she needed something, when she was a little baby. She's just like, get us all on alert. She wanted something. Sophia was just chill. She'd be like, meh. Look around, see if anyone got that. You know?
Yeah.
No? Okay. I'm all right. I'll wait.
Yeah.
Because it's going to come.
Right. Mellow. Nice. So you kind of, you know, illustrated your life in various ways, starting with your love of the Dharma and moving into your relationship with Dina and your love of Chinese medicine and then your daughters. Mm. And I'm just curious how they've all woven together and like the evolution of those loves maybe have evolved each other. And if you have something to share on that.
Yeah, it keeps on going. Keep on falling in love and be in love. That's what it's saying to me.
Mm-hmm.
How we define ourselves, actually, you know, it's like how we're able to see those the formative relationships, which are based on love and bonding, and to understand that's what humans are about. That's what we're all about, is to come from that space more consistently.
Right.
And my eldest asked me some interesting question the other day. She was like, are there things that can't be understood logically? Because the school, the way the we learn in schools, seems like everything is all sewn up, all wrapped up. You know, we got this figured out. This is the curriculum. When you're in math, of course, if you're going to plug in these things, you have this problem, you're going to get that answer, and it's going to be the right answer.
Mm-hmm.
There's only one. And in matters of the heart, which it turns out is what really matters, we have to go beyond our ordinary rational thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And these exercise, the way that we fall in love and have these stories that we can relate to in our own lives about love, it's part of that education of the heart, which isn't necessarily reasonable or logical, but is so important. It's so practical anyway. Because what the world needs now is love, sweet love. And if we want more peace in the world, we can't fight for peace. We can love for peace, though. We can love fiercely for peace.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that'll help it come around a lot faster.
I like it. Thank you so much for sharing with us and to appear into your life there, Adam, and your own love stories. It's quite magical and romantic.
My pleasure, truly.
Absolutely. And naturally, I would assume that the love of Chinese medicine and the love of Buddhism dancing in the relationship that you have with your wife and your children, mm-hmm. and back and forth. Like, when you're seeking deeper in your practice, finding ways to love deeper in your relationship with your family, and yeah. vice versa, being able to bring that back to your family and yeah. have them love and
yeah.
have a glimpse of what really drives you.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing. Yeah. Beautiful. So, if you're tuning in, I hope that you had a great time listening to Adam's stories as I did, and getting to know a little bit more behind the host, Adam Mose, of Love in the 21st Century, and also to take an opportunity to peer into yourself about what stories would you tell if you were asked to tell a love story, because we all have them, and there's ones that come to mind more prominently, and then there's ones that come to mind maybe after we've heard a story or two, we go, oh yeah, maybe I do have a few more love stories than I thought about. So I hope it was thought-provoking. It surely was for me. And we will be back with you next Tuesday at 5 o'clock. And as Adam mentioned, he does have a Chinese medicine class that happens on Wednesday mornings. For anybody that was hearing that part and interested, that's 9 o'clock at...
at my place, Acupuncture and Herbs. And AcuAdam.com has all the details.
Perfect. So stay tuned for Ecotopia coming up next. Ecotopia is hosted every Tuesday from 6 to 7 with Stephen and Susan Chudy. They discuss environmental issues with nationally renowned authors and activists. EcoTalk, it's your local link to a global network of folks who know and care about the health of our planet. Love in the 21st Century is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by one of Chico's newest restaurants, Rolla's West, at 234 West 3rd Street in the heart of downtown. Rolla's West offers small and large plates, Maryland-style shrimp, blue crab cakes, a wine bar, charcuterie, and Arsenal cheeses. Rolla's West is open from 5 till 9 p.m. and 10 on Friday and Saturday. For more information, visit them on Facebook or by calling 636-4468.
Is back. North Valley Community Foundation's 10th annual fundraising program is underway August 1st through September 30th. Go to anniebees.org and find KZFR and click to donate. That's anniebees.org, A-N-N-I-E-B-S.org. Or you can write a check to Annie Bees, KZFR, and mail it to NVCF 240 Main Street, Suite 260, Chico, California, 95928. You can also click on the link at our website, kzfr.org. Thanks for listening, and thanks for supporting community radio through Annie B's, 90.1 KZFR.
Paradise, put up a parking lot with a
pink hotel, a boutique, and a swinging hot spot. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? It pays paradise, put up a parking lot. Trees, put them in a tree museum, and they charge the people $1.50 just to see them. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They pay paradise, put up a parking lot. Hey, farmer, farmer, put away the DDT now. Give me spots on my apples, but leave me the birds and the bees. Please, don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They pay paradise, put up a parking lot. Late last night, I heard the screen door slam, and a big yellow taxi took away my old man. To go, that you don't know what you've got till it's gone. They pay paradise, put up a parking lot. I said, don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They pay paradise, put up a parking lot. They pay paradise, put up a parking lot.
You are listening to FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. Up next, Ecotopia, exploring the possibility of an all-electric America. Ecotopia is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by the Printed Image, specializing in custom screen printing and embroidery in Chico since 1980. Using the latest technology in their state-of-the-art building, the Printed Image provides custom screen printing, embroidery, and promotional products for business, organizations,